Husband, father, Elmo impersonator?
Yeah!
He wrote The Arm and is currently writing its follow-up, The Leg. He has everyone's phone number, even yours. He's MLB insider Jeff Passan of ESPN, only on the program.
Welcome back into the program. I'm Todd Lebo in for Sorin Petro. Very excited on this Thursday night because that means I get to talk to Jeff Passan, who is the best in the biz when it comes to covering Major League Baseball and especially the trade deadline stuff that was happening this week. First of all, Passan, have you recovered from the trade deadline? I know that's an intense, crazy day for you baseball insiders.
I have not, but that's okay. I'm older. I realize it takes a little longer to recover now, but I will get there. I will be okay. I hope I make it through the end of this interview. I might be wheezing by the end.
Well, you know, the odd thing is, too, you know, they've added a couple of hours to it because it used to be like, you know, 4 Eastern. And then if that wasn't enough, let's just make 2 more hours of drama, right?
Yeah, so they added 2 days and 2 hours.
Yeah, just give us more. Give us more. And that was wild. Take us through. You guys are on the air on television while this is all going down. How many phones do all of you insiders have working? What's that like when you're doing that show as it's happening on the air?
So I would love to be at the main Carl Ravitch and Buster Olney and Tim Kirkjian and Eduardo Perez were, but I'm on my phone so much it would just make for horrendous TV.
Right.
Because I would just be looking at my phone and not saying anything. So I get thrown over to the kids' table, we call it. Kylie McDaniel and I, there's a little side stage there. And if we have something, we talk into our mic and our producer hears us and says into Carl's ear, throw it over to Passan, and that is how the sausage is made there. And it's fun, it's exhilarating, it's invigorating, it's horrifying. It is a giant mix of emotions, but I would not want to do anything other than what I get to do every day. I'm a very, very lucky person.
It was a lot of fun because we were living the same thing. You know, we're sitting here watching the television, looking at your Twitter feeds, watching everything go, and it's getting right up to 5 o'clock. We have our little break right before the end, and I said as we went to break, here's the deal. Adam, how long is the music going to be? Says we got 3 minutes of music, and then 3 minutes of breaks. I said, here's what's going to happen. In this 3 minutes, they're going to make a trade, and that's exactly what happened because the Merrifield trade, the Royals trade, was right at the very, very end. And let's just talk generally about that, because I think what we dealt with was 3 hours of angry Royals fans saying, are these guys not going to trade anyone? This team is not competing. They need to do something. And they finally did. So in generally speaking, did the Royals do enough at the trading deadline to satisfy what they should be doing?
I think they got close, but I don't know that they necessarily did everything that they could or should have done. And listen, trading Andrew Benintendi was a no-brainer, right? Like, he's going to be a free agent, probably not going to resign him for what he's going to demand, and so you move him. And they got 3 pitching prospects out of it. I will be very curious to see how those pitching prospects who excelled in the New York Yankees organization take to what the Royals do. The Emmanuel Rivera trade I thought was interesting. There were a lot of thumbs down from people around the industry because they don't buy Luke Weaver at this point. They think the stuff's down, too injury prone, not a lot of service time left. But Luke Weaver was a guy who was extremely effective a few years ago, looked like he was going to be a mainstay in the Diamondbacks' big league rotation. And the Royals clearly saw something there that they feel like they can bring out of him. And I think Rivera is one of those guys who, because he doesn't have that spectacular carrying tool, you can't project him to be a great player. But generally speaking, I think that evaluators with whom I've spoken thought Rivera is at least a serviceable big leaguer and someone who, because he's extremely early in his career, has a lot of club control left and is going to be around for a while. The Whit Merrifield trade, I think the Royals just wanted to get rid of Whit Merrifield. I think that's what it ultimately boils down to. And Of all the takers, the Toronto Blue Jays were not the team that I was expecting. After a few weeks ago, he wasn't even able to play there. Questions over his vaccination status and his willingness to get the COVID-19 vaccine. I figured it was going to be a much easier and softer landing. So seeing what happens to Whit Merrifield and seeing what he chooses over the next few weeks is one of those stories that I'm looking forward to following, because I just don't know where it's going to go. And there are so many different possibilities as to what his choices ultimately lead to. And he's got some very big decisions to make.
Yeah, we're talking to Jeff Passan from ESPN about the trade deadline and everything that's gone down. And, you know, we got to talk to J.J. Piccolo that evening. They had a Zoom, and he said that, you know, the vaccination status, it had nothing to do with the fact they were going to trade him. But I felt in the moment when we were talking about this at 5 o'clock after it happened, I just kind of felt that not his decision to not get vaccinated, but the way his comments afterwards were not what you want from. So I think he had kind of written, it was written on the wall at that point that this was not someone who they particularly needed to be a leader and be kind of in charge of the clubhouse, as it were, moving forward, because it just wasn't the, and he tried to explain it, but the message was the message, and it was received, and people heard what he said first and not what he said later, and it was a horrible look, and it angered and frustrated everyone in the organization.
I think that's the right way to put it. It wasn't the action, it was the words, and sometimes that's the case, but let's not look past the action either. You know, not just him, but a number of players, 10 players on the team, made the choice to put their own well-being ahead of the team's success. And look, I can't begrudge a person for making an individual decision if that's what he truly believes is important. I will take my personal liberties over the wishes of my employer 8 days a week. That's just like that. I think that's a good way to lead your life, but it's also a very privileged way to lead your life too, especially in a team sport where the consequences of that, if you have the liberty to make decisions, right? But you also have to understand that those decisions are going to come with consequences. And I think the consequence of this decision combined with the words afterward said to the Royals, this is not a person we want to be around here in our future, even though he's only got 1 year left on his contract.
I was wondering if this team, and it's easy to look at the Royals season and the way things have played out and go, why in the world would they have possibly thought they were going to be competitive this year? But they clearly did at the beginning of the year. Had they been that way, had they spent the first few months kind of staying above water or near the break-even mark, and going into that situation in Toronto, they were somewhat in the race. Do you think they would have had 10 guys who weren't vaxxed?
Nope, I do not.
Yeah, I think that's the obvious answer. And what we don't know, Jeff, is, you know, we know that like maybe 2.5-3 weeks before they're supposed to go to Toronto, they kind of had an update. You know, they talked to everyone where we stand. There might have been 15 guys who weren't vaccinated, and then five of them got back. I don't know. Mm-hmm. We don't know that yet. So it's just interesting. And this thing, and like I said, I don't care what you believe, how are you going to do it, but the rules that are in place in the game that you play are what they are, and then you make your choices from there. And what's set with really wrong with Royals fans was, you know, that if we were any better, well, part of the reason you're not any better is because you're not playing well. You know, it's
right.
Just, it all
right.
Just goes together. It all goes together. So you think, what do you call it, B-minus trade deadline for the Royals, C, or where we at? Because we all saw these relievers getting traded, and we're like, oh, Scott Barlow's worth a ton. You know, the market looked hot, and that never happened, and it didn't seem like it was really something that they considered.
I don't know that Scott Barlow was worth a ton. I think that's why he didn't move. You know, there were some signs, according to scouts that I was talking with, that his stuff was down a little bit, and that there just wasn't as much value. And I think one thing we have to understand, especially about relievers, when a reliever gets to arbitration, Scott Barlow was in his first year of arbitration this year, got two more years to go. When relievers get to arbitration, they get paid for one thing and one thing only, and that is saves. And Scott Barlow had 16 saves last year. He's making $2.5 million this year. If he did not have those saves, he would probably be making half that. And he's got 17 more saves this year, and one would have to assume that he's going to wind up somewhere in the 25 to 30 save range. And he's due for a very big raise this winter, up to, you know, the $5-plus million, maybe $6 million range. So he's starting to get a little expensive, and I think teams look at what they can get out of their minor league system right now at a fraction of the cost and say, is Scott Barlow really worth $6 million a year plus whatever we have to give up in prospect value, which is going to be pretty significant because he's good. It's why when you see relievers move, generally speaking, it's the ones who are about to be free agents. I'm not sure how many cost-controlled relievers went this year. I think, you know, top of my head, Scott Efros was one of the only ones. And he's a guy who came into this year with barely any service time. Yankees are going to have him for five more years after this year. And, look, they paid a pretty hefty price to do so. You know, the Cubs got Hayden Wesneski, who's one of the better players who got traded at the deadline here. So I think that moving relief pitchers, moving Barlow in this situation was going to be a tough thing to do.
He wasn't the centerpiece of a major trade, but I'm intrigued by Max Castillo, who came over in the Merrifield trade.
Yeah.
23 years old, made his debut this year. If you knock away what wasn't a terrible first outing, he allowed two runs over one inning. His last eight appearances, 2.29 ERA. He has five walks, 19 strikeouts, and 19 and two-thirds with an opponent's OPS of 5.33. That seems like he might be a starter. It could be a nice reliever. What do you think they got in Castillo? What's his ceiling?
I think they got a good fastball and a good changeup and kind of an iffy breaking ball. And the question about Max Castillo and whether he's a starter or a reliever is going to depend on his ability to turn that slider into a weapon. If his slider comes around, then Max Castillo has a chance to stick at the back end of a rotation. If not, you know, a fastball changeup guy out of the bullpen, right-hander, that's a guy who pitches five-plus years in the big leagues. He doesn't look pretty. He's a large, large man, but we've seen some thicks on the mound before, and we're going to see some thicks on the mound going forward. And I think figuring out where he slots in with Brady Singer and Chris Bubich and Daniel Lynch and Jonathan Bolin and Alec Marsh and, you know, all of these arms that they've, Jackson Coar. I mean, the Royals have a lot of arms. Luke Weaver's another one of them, potentially.
And he looked pretty good yesterday.
They're going to have to cobble a rotation out of that or go spend some money in free agency. And that to me is the big story going into this winter for the Royals. Is after as disappointing a season as this has been, with the farm really kind of barren at this point, guys, with Pasquantino up, with Prado up, with Massey up, with Bobby Witt, with MJ Melendez, Daniel Lynch. I mean, all the guys who came into this year as the best prospects for the Kansas City Royals are now with the team, right? This is when you're supposed to supplement with free agents. Are the Royals going to be a team that goes out and aggressively spends this winter? Because if not, then I think it's awfully problematic going forward because the team that they've got right now is not good enough to win a division.
No, and that's going to be the big challenge for John Sherman and his crew. Like, I've said this about 10 times on the air. I don't generally feel bad for people who have billions of dollars, okay? But this is a guy who bought a baseball team, and then immediately there was a pandemic, and then there was a lockout, and then they can't watch the games on TV around here because of the Bally's thing with YouTube TV. It has not been a graceful takeoff here for John Sherman's deal, but eventually you're going to have to go spend some money on some of these things.
And if you don't, then don't tell me next spring that you think you're in a position to contend.
Yeah. Yeah. Listen, hope is something you can sell. And I think that hope was sold this year, and when it's not realized, it leaves a bitter taste.
Yep.
It turns people skeptical. So what the Royals have lost here is the benefit of the doubt. And the only way you can win that back is by winning something else, ball games.
Yeah, for sure. And there are long ways to go there, because every time you think something good is happening, and then it doesn't. But Jeff Passan is our guest. All right, so the crazy big story, obviously, on trade deadline day was Juan Soto getting trading. And it wasn't a surprise, because it looked like it was going to happen when he decided he didn't want $400 million or whatever. So that thing happened.
Yep.
Now, the way this comes back to Kansas City is they make this big trade, and then all of a sudden Eric Hosmer's in it, and he's like, nah, I'm not doing this, man. It's just, it's so baseball-y to say that, hey, we're doing this, and no one checked with Haas to see if he could, and then, the way the thing works.
Yeah, you can't check with him beforehand, though. Like, you want to get the deal in place,
right,
and then check. But, yeah, I get your point.
Yeah, well, and Boris has all these clients, right? And didn't he just orchestrate this whole thing? I don't know. What do you think of what the Padres have done here? Are they going to offer this guy $500 million, or are they just going to use him for a couple of years and then try to trade him at some point? Where do you think Juan Soto will eventually sign his mega deal?
Oh, boy. That's a tough one. I think the Padres want to sign him. I think they want a core of him, Tatis, and Machado, but we know at this point, after he turned down $440 million, that it's going to take a number that starts with a five, right? And I think he wants to – this is not a priority for Juan Soto, I don't think. I don't think he sits there at night thinking to himself, I want to be the first $500 million player. What he does think, I believe, is that he is a unique talent, and – that in professional sports, unique talents get paid uniquely. And that's a, like, you sit here and say, well, that's a frivolous thing to say, $440 million, what's the difference between that and $500 million? Still generational wealth. It's still great. Now, I think it's about valuing yourself. If you know how hard you work, the hours you put in, the time you put in, the way that you take this God-given talent that you have and leverage it into something great. Isn't it just human to want others to recognize that as well and to be compensated accordingly?
Sure.
I do not begrudge Juan Soto one bit for turning down $440 million. Now, would I have done it? No, I wouldn't have. But my risk calculation is different than his. And I have a difficult time sitting here judging somebody else's risk, risk matrix, because it's an arrogant thing to do to sit here and suggest that just because I think a particular way means that other people should. No, everybody has different levels of risk that they're willing to take, and his risk matrix clearly shows that he believes the reward exceeds the risk, and I applaud him for that. I wish I had cojones the size of Juan Soto's, but there's a reason that I'm behind a keyboard and he's in a batter's box.
Yeah.
I read somewhere that the four biggest contracts in MLB history have been extensions, not free agent signings. Trout, Betts, Lindor, and Tatis.
Yep.
So is that something of a sea change recently? I think that would surprise a lot of baseball observers. It certainly surprised me to some extent, because I hadn't really thought about it in that context.
Yeah, But I also, I mean, one of those things is not like the others. The Tatis extension was, I mean, truly unique.
That's
you know,
true.
A guy barely a year into his career getting the, what, their fourth highest contract in big league history. I mean, getting more than Bryce Harper on the free agent market, getting more than Giancarlo Stanton in his extension. That was a unique one. The Trout, though, he expressed that he wanted to stay in Anaheim. Angels made it happen. Mookie Betts, the Dodgers traded for him specifically to get him locked up long term. And what was the other one I'm missing? Lindor. You know, the Mets, same thing. It was analogous to the Betts deal. They wanted Francisco Lindor, and they gave up a lot of talent for him because they thought that they could extend him. I think there's hope in San Diego that they can do the same with Soto. But if you get to that point, let's just say it's around 500, you have $1.14 billion. That's $1,140,000,000 tied up in three guys in a market that's the 10th smallest in Major League Baseball. That's a tough thing to pull off. And if they can, you know, already all the credit in the world to the Padres for saying, we feel like our window is now and we want to leverage it and take advantage of it. So let's go get the best player who's been available on the trade market in 15 years since Miguel Cabrera. Mm-hmm. Let's go do that. And in the process, prevent our rival, who's already better than us, from getting him. To do Juan Soto, Josh Bell, Brandon Drury, and Josh Hader in a 26-27 hour period was unbelievable to see, but not surprising because this is how the Padres operate. They're very, very willing, much like Juan Soto, to take that risk.
Jeff Passan of ESPN is our MLB insider. You hear him every Thursday here in the program. We talked about Soto and the money. How does it translate to the field? Right now there are four kind of monolithic teams, all on pace for over 102 wins, Yankees, Astros, Mets, and Dodgers. Will the addition of Soto and the expected return of Fernando Tatis Jr. be enough to put the Padres up in that mix?
Well, they've won five in a row already, Curtis, so they're on a bit of a jag right now. I don't know that they are necessarily up there with those teams, but I think they're probably right in the echelon below them. You can make an argument that the Padres and Atlanta Braves belong in there, and that those are really the six standout teams in baseball right now, and if you have those six versus the field, you're going to take one of those six to win the World Series. That said, the Padres' issue has always been depth, right? Like, they have all these stars on their team, but what does their depth look like? And listen, it got a lot better because they got Josh Bell, too, and they got Brandon Drury. The area that concerns me the most is probably the bullpen. You know, their best reliever this year has been Nabil Chrismat. So when your best reliever's been Nabil Chrismat, who's throwing 92, maybe 93, and is kind of a junk baller, and, you know, his main thing is that he throws strikes, it's not the kind of dominant stuff that you want. I mean, when you have a bullpen of Nabil Chrismat, Luis Garcia, Craig Stamen, Tim Hill, Robert Suarez, it could be a little better. And getting Josh Hader helps, certainly, but I'm not sure it makes their bullpen as playoff-ready as some other organizations, particularly those on that list.
We're talking to Jeff Passan here on our Thursday visit. The biggest part of the Mount Rushmore of sports broadcasters maybe in our history, certainly in the game's history, Vin Scully passed away this last week. And like I said yesterday, I'm not sad because he was 94 years old or whatever.
Yeah.
And he lived a life that no one has ever lived. But just how long was Vin Scully's shadow in the world of baseball?
He cast it over an entire metropolitan area in Los Angeles, and I think once people realized how good he was, it expanded well beyond that to cover the entirety of the country. The best thing that happened to Vin Scully was the internet, right? Before we had every game streaming into our homes on a nightly basis, before we had the ability to cut small clips and post them to social media, the only time we got to hear Vin Scully was during the postseason.
Right.
And that was a great privilege, and that was an exciting thing, but it also was, you know, it also was almost a tease. Like, we get to hear this person who calls games in such an inimitable fashion. You can try to be like Vin Scully, but you're not. And you can try and steal little things from him, whether it's his willingness to let a game breathe or his desire to find out things about players that other broadcasters simply don't. That's effort, that's work, that's style, that's the entire package. But what ultimately, to me, defined Vin Scully was what he did in big moments. Like that to me is the sign of a great broadcaster. When he or she can make a moment feel as large as it actually is and can put the words to something instantaneously that he or she didn't know was going to happen. I mean, that right there is a special talent. And Vin Scully was as good in big moments, I think, as anyone.
And what made it even more noticeable with him was because he also knew how to get the heck out of the way of the moment.
Yes.
He always talked about how important he thought the voice of the crowd, or the roar of the crowd, was to him, even as a kid. So for a guy who was known for the words that he said to also have been so good at not saying anything at all, really combines the two best things you'd want in a broadcaster the way nobody ever has.
Yeah, when I said letting it breathe, that's what I meant by that. That,
yep.
You know, it's broadcasting can be an exercise in arrogance. Like, I'm going to tell you what I think about this situation. And a lot of times, because of a broadcaster's knowledge or expertise, that's okay. But what Vin Scully always understood is that he's not the story. The story is what's going on, and his job is to set it up, present it, contextualize it, make it interesting, but still let the story stand on its own. And he was very spare, you know, for somebody who spoke as many words in his life as he did. He was very spare in his descriptions and very elegant in the way that he looked at life. I would have loved to spend an hour in Vin Scully's head just to see the world the way that he saw it.
Yeah, it'd be pretty good. Jeff Passan's our guest. We better get hustling here. Time for our Final Four, brought to you by the University of Kansas Health System. All right, so yesterday Frank Bohl made us really sick when he said he didn't think the Royals were going to be anywhere near competing until like 2027. Is he wrong? It's going to be before that, right?
I mean, I hope so.
Is there any evidence that it could be before that?
I think we're gonna find out next year. Like I just don't know what they're gonna do this off season, but that's gonna make a big difference. I will say this: I think Pasquantino's gonna be a good big leaguer. I think Prado's gonna be a good big leaguer. I think Witt's gonna be a good big leaguer. I think Melendez is gonna be a good big leaguer. There are worse places to start than having four young, controllable centerpiece-type guys. So I will not sit here and say 2027 because, one, that's depressing, but, two, I just don't buy it.
All right, number two here. Do you have a kind of a favorite trade deadline deal that you've in the history of you covering the game that made an impact that you still remember today?
Oh, my goodness. I mean, impact on the field or impact on me?
Yeah, just one that you like. Maybe one that you helped break, or just one that was like, wow, that deal really worked for that team.
CeCe Sabathia to the Brewers. If you go and look back, I believe he finished fourth in the Cy Young despite starting only 17 games. I think he had 8 complete games and 3 shutouts. As great a performance as I've seen from a starting pitcher post-deadline. Him, Randy Johnson, even Max Scherzer last year. I love seeing starting pitchers get traded and just shove.
Yeah. All right. What's the worst trade deadline deal? One that you thought was going to stink from the beginning, and then you're like, oh, yeah, that didn't work out. They gave up way too much, and they got nothing for it.
Oh, my God. The worst deadline deal. I'm blanking on that right now. There have been some stinkers, don't get me wrong, but nothing coming to mind right now.
No problem. I know I put you on the spot with that one. All right, finally, yep. I thought this was an interesting thing that the Royals, their 20th round draft pick, this high school kid named Austin Charles, who J.J. Piccolo said the other day, I don't want to put a name on this guy, but he said Aaron Judge. So, okay, you put a name on a guy. He gave him $400,000, a high school kid in the 20th round. Is this a good sign for the Royals that they were willing to take a risk on someone who a lot of people didn't think could be signed and they were able to get that done?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if Aaron Judge is the right comp. I mean, he's a big kid. He's played shortstop, but he's certainly not going to stick around there. He does hit the ball quite hard, though, and he does throw the ball quite hard. And I don't know that they're going to do this, but I would love to see them try him as a two-way guy. Shohei Ohtani has opened up an entirely new world for players in which – The possibility of doing this is much more realistic now. You're never going to do it at his level. He's just better than you. You come to terms with that. But man, it's a pretty tempting thing to try to do because you see how much value is derived there. And by the way, I have an answer. I thought of one. Derek Lowe and Jason Varitek for Heathcliff Slocum.
There you go.
That's probably the worst trade to it. There have been a lot of bad deals that involve young prospects being moved for rentals. Adrian Gonzalez and Scott Kazmir going to the Rays, and Nelson Cruz going to the Rangers, and there was the Mark Teixeira deal. There have been a lot of bad trades at the deadline, and all you hope is that you're not that one.
Yeah, well, it wasn't a deadline deal, but Fernando Tatis Jr. was in the deal for James Shields from the White Sox. So there's one right there. That was the wild card that,
It wasn't deadline, but it was I think early June when it happened. So yeah, that's a really horrendous one, no doubt.
Yeah. Yeah, you never know what a guy's going to turn into for sure. Hey, Passan, thank you so much for your time. We appreciate it. And it's only, 363 days till the next trade deadline, right? So you have time to rest and relax.
Can't wait.
All right, that's Jeff Passan right here on the program. We'll keep it rolling here on a Thursday.
Impress your friends, amaze your coworkers, make your family proud. Here's what you need to know. I'ma tell you
what you need to know. But first, a good sense into the hour answer. Funneling off of our Roger Clemens question earlier today, which was, who's the only Royal to homer twice off Clemens? What member of the 500 home run club hit his first homer off Clemens? 1989, he played for the White Sox at that time, I believe.
Franks Thomas.
About Sammy Sosa.
Sammy Sosa. Yeah, they're very good. Very good. All right, let's tell you what you need to know. Chiefs camp went well today. They're off tomorrow. We heard from Carlos Dunlap today. Much more Chiefs coming up on Crunch Time with Frank Bohl and Tim Grunhard.
Patrick Mahomes there almost.
I did. That's how you do that one.
Yeah, man.
Frank is excited, he said. He's in there. He said this is going to be the best Crunch Time they've ever done.
Wow.
He's just screaming and doing push-ups. It's pretty intense.
Yeah, it is.
He's constructing mountains in your office and climbing.
Just to climb. So that's coming up. Much more Chiefs sound there. But let's do some baseball stuff here. The Royals are facing the Red Sox. Eric Hosmer's in town. Mm-hmm. So let's hear a little bit of that as we go. But first, we told you last hour, we were talking about Whit Merrifield, and he is in Minnesota, and he's playing. We told him, when the trade happened, he's going to Toronto. He hadn't been vaccinated when he was going up there. And I said that day, I don't know if he's gotten vaccinated since. I don't know how long it's going to take, whatever. But he met with the Toronto media today while they're on the road with the team. And apparently he will be good to go when they reach town.
For a couple weeks now, I've understood that this might be a possibility. And I'll be in Toronto when the team goes there.
Have you had the vaccine?
Yeah.
When you had it, just so we have a general timeline of when you'll be able to come to Toronto?
I'll be in Toronto when the team gets to Toronto.
So.
Just
there you have
just
it.
Say when you got it.
We're putting this to bed now. Whit Merrifield is good to go for the Jays. And there it is. Good enough for the Jays, not good enough for the Royals. That's where I'll leave it. Okay. So it is interesting. I know this, that the trade deadline was Tuesday.
Yes.
I know when the trade deadline started, I did not expect Eric Hosmer to be in Kansas City on Thursday. And I really didn't expect it at 1 o'clock on Tuesday when Eric Hosmer was supposed to be traded to Washington. But he said
he
no.
Even, he ain't even coming when the Padres
He said
here.
No, and the Padres said, we still don't want you to be on our team because we got Josh Bell back in this trade, so we're going to trade you to the Red Sox. And the Padres are playing a pretty big chunk of this money, I believe. So anyway, Eric Hosmer's fine. I like Eric Hosmer. He helped hang a banner, and he got $100 million from the Padres, and he's going to be playing elsewhere now. But he's here now. We all knew he was going to come back to Kansas City at the end of this month with the Padres, but that didn't happen. He has not played here since he left just because the kind of how the schedule works, right?
Well,
they
don't
play the Padres a lot.
Padres were supposed to come in 20, but then that was when
that
they only
canceled.
Played the NL Central
yep.
because of
the pandemic. And then he was supposed to be here at the end of this month. You know, Lorenzo Cain had been here, and then Moose stayed and came back. And, you know, there's a lot of the things. This is one of the guys who just it hadn't happened yet. And he was going to get a very nice round of applause when he gets here, and he will get a great round of applause tonight from whoever's out there.
You know, he is apparently a big fan of mine because he waited until my birthday to hit his first major league home run.
Did he do it?
Yeah.
He's so
that's
nice. Right. I do remember being out there when they called him up. They called him up on, it was after a day game. They came in.
May 6th was his first game.
It was Cinco de Mayo when they did it. They called him up, and then he showed up the next day. Or I think we were on the road, whatever it was. But they told us they're calling him up. It was after a day game.
No, they were at home his first deep debut.
So he played there.
They played the A's at his debut.
It was A's home.
Yeah.
They told us the day before they were calling Eric Hosmer up. I mean, Dayton Moore came in. It was after the game. They're like, FYI, here's the deal. We're calling Eric Hosmer. But, oh, my gosh, Eric Hosmer's coming up. And that was an important thing. And so Dayton Moore was available today talking about kind of what that meant to have Eric Hosmer finally make it to the bigs.
You know, I can remember like it was yesterday, his debut in Kansas City, and we named his arrival to the major leagues. We called it Operation Flip the Switch. You know, it was just a very significant moment in the history of our franchise and the growth, the beginning of a new era, and the growth of a player and a team that ultimately won a World Series. And, you know, Eric Hosmer was... He was the focus of that, as was others. But, I mean, Haas was just a special part of that journey.
A month later, I told Eric Hosmer that Mike Moustakas was coming up because it was also after an afternoon game, and I was out there, and I said, yeah, they just told us your buddy's coming up. He's like, oh, really? Because it was about a month later that Mike Moustakas came up. It was pretty crazy. So Hosmer was obviously a very high draft pick. He was a high school player, and Dayton Moore said they thought something was special about him from when they watched him back when he was young.
That is the moment that I will always reflect back on because watching him play in high school, I felt, as did others, we all felt this way, that he would win a gold glove, and the way he carried himself and to watch his teammates gravitate towards him was truly unique. He was the man on the field, and everybody knew it. But the neat thing about Eric Hosmer, I noticed how everybody gravitated towards him, but he treated everybody else like they were the star.
Everyone there talking about Eric Hosmer.
Everyone who's ever talked about Hosmer and when he came up and the way he has always been, has been that. I mean, there's something about him. And anyone who's ever talked to him or seen him, you get what this is. I don't really describe it to you. But there's a shot of him in the Royals dugout with a couple of the other young players, just the way he's sitting and looking. You're like, that's the guy. That's the star.
would you guys, this was when I was just a fan, you guys were covering it at the time. Would you agree, I mean, their numbers, I can't remember what their numbers were in Omaha. Would you agree that the Hosmer coming first and Moustakas following had as much or more with it, with his to do with his personality than the numbers?
Could be. I think he was doing a little bit better there at the minor leagues. But he was a guy who they had looked at as a leader. And here's what we'll be excited about. I know Frank Bowles said the Royals aren't ever going to win again. Actually didn't say that. But and you know what Passan just told us was it's a good place to start with some of the young players they had. That they have right now. Okay, mm-hmm. It's a good place to start. If you go back and look at the 2011 season or 2012 when all these guys played, they weren't very good. No. I mean, the Royals lost 90 games in 2012. Nope. So maybe there's a place for these guys to start with a pretty good group of players here. They need to obviously make it better, but let's hope that some of the players they have now would be a good place. So Hosmer met with the media today because he's back in town. He was in the old media room today. And there's not a lot of guys around here who he knew, but one of them for sure is Sal Perez.
For a couple weeks now, I've understood that this.
I don't know why Whit Merrifield has anything to say about this, but.
Are you throwing to the right one? 14?
Well, we'll go 14 then. All right, let's go to 14. Are you ready with 14? Let's go with 14.
I'm ready with all of them. I just went, that was Dayton's last one was 12, and I went straight to 13because I'm an
let's
idiot.
Let's go to 14. So. All right. And one of the things we're talking about, maybe there weren't stars on the Royals, and maybe there aren't stars now who are coming in. Maybe maybe Bobby Witt Jr. would be a star. But they won the whole thing, and they winning as a group is an important thing.
Ultimately, when you get to the big leagues, you realize this is the hardest stop of them all, and it's going to – you know, stuff doesn't change in a year. It's not going to go from good year to bad year. You got to fight through some stuff. You got to make through some adjustments, and you got to learn as a team and individually. And I think that's what we did real well. We learned stuff individually and as a team, and kind of collabed our ideas off of each other. We all came up together. It was a big group that felt extremely comfortable bouncing different ideas off each other, and ultimately we just figured it out as a group. And I think that's what made it the most special.
Yeah, they did get it done as a group, and that was important. Like I said, people love Hosmer, and it's he's going to have a nice round of applause out there. I know this has not been the most fun week of his life. You know, it's not, this ain't been all that fun for him to get traded. Going from the Padres to the Red Sox are in last place, by the way. Now, they're better than the Nationals, who were even last place. But it's never fun to get traded away from something that's good to something that's not quite as good. But he'll be a pro about it, and he'll be just fine, okay?
Yep.
So he's going to look around here. This is weird to be on the other side of the stadium and not in the home dugout and all that. And there's not a whole lot of guys rolling around that home dugout that he knows who are on the field. I mean, there's plenty of personnel people that he'll know and all that. But one of the old guys who he will know for sure is Sal Perez, because they came up and did a lot of special things together.
You know, this is Salvador Perez, his team, his stadium, and he's the guy that this team's built around. So just as a teammate and as a friend, I'm, you know, extremely happy for him, extremely proud of everything he's done here. And the teammate and the man he is, it's something that the fans of Kansas City should be really proud of, having him as their catcher. And I know he doesn't take that lightly. He comes in here ready to play and ready to work every day.
What was it like seeing him today?
It was crazy. It was crazy seeing him. You know, I'd seen him in a couple times in the off season, just real quick, but to get to sit down and just kind of catch up with him, it was fun. It was just fun to kind of see where everyone's at, catch up with everybody here. And you know, it feels like it's been a lot longer than it actually has, but just to catch up with everybody and see some faces around here I haven't seen in a while has been really cool so far.
All right, I'm looking at the 16 roster or the 17 roster. That was his last year here, right?
Yeah.
So you got Salvi, and he played with Hunter Dozier for a smidge in 16.
Mm-hmm.
It's a pretty short list, and I guess Witt's gone.
Yeah. Yeah, that's.
Does there end the list, Curtis?
Taking a peek, you said 17, right?
Right, that was his last year with the team. Brandon Moss isn't rolling around here anymore, is he?
Nope, let's look at the pitching staff.
An injury keeps Mondesi from being here.
I mean, maybe, I haven't seen Mondesi. I don't think he's hanging around out there. But
but he's an example of somebody who probably would be otherwise, if not for otherwise.
Cam Gallagher's gone now, too, right? He just got traded.
Yep.
Jason Hamill is no longer on this team.
No, it's just Salvi.
Danny Duffy gone last year. I mean, he obviously seen some of these guys in the preseason or the training camp or whatever, but Seth Maness, remember him?
Mm-hmm.
He's not here?
Nope.
Al Albuquerque? Is Nate Karns walking through those doors to say hello?
Peter Moylan, not there.
Love Peter Moylan. So what we got is we got Salvi.
That was it. Last man standing.
Yep, last man standing. There's Eric Hosmer. It'll be fun to see.
We're almost done for the day, but there's just a few more things we'd like to share.
But there's still more.
Here's the kicker.
Here's the kicker of this whole thing.
On the program.
Yeah, we don't have a few more things because we've gone long. I don't. This happens every week. Doesn't matter who's talking to Jeff Passan, we go long.
Yes.
Jeff Passan likes to talk, and we
Jeff
go long.
Knows a lot of things, and we have questions to ask, and he's going to answer every one of them. So.
A lot of questions about that, for sure.
We could have gone 15 more minutes easy with him.
Here's my kicker.
Okay.
You come, if you would like to go to the 100-year anniversary for WHB next Thursday, great chance to get tickets tomorrow morning, 8 to 10 in the morning.
Where will you be?
I'm going to be at KC Cards and Collectibles in Lee's Ummet.
Lee's Ummet.
Whose Ummet is it?
Lee's
It's Ummet. Lee's Ummet. And it's just off 50 Highway, north of 50 Highway. If you know where Johnny Ray's Drive-In is or the Jumpin' Catfish, it's in the strip mall right around there, 8 to 10 tomorrow. I'm going to be giving away multiple pairs of tickets. Some registration, and some of them, you get there, I'm going to give you tickets. So be listening tomorrow morning, the Border Patrol. Come by KC Cards and Collectibles. Make sure you get a chance to come to this crazy party that we're having next Thursday at the Midland. It's going to be fun. And then we'll be back here tomorrow to do this, too.
Is it owned by the former Pirates second baseman, Johnny Rays?
I don't know. It's not.
Or the subject of the Dexy's Midnight Runners song?
No.
It's not poor old Johnny Ray?
It's not, but I do like Johnny Ray's Drive-In.
Everyone
I enjoy
does.
It a lot. Crunch Time is up next here on Sports Radio 810 WHB. And then we got football tonight, the Hall of Fame game. We got football happening. And then we're going to get St. John out of his cocoon of pillows.